This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, it is good to have you with us here as we have our weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also from Britain, we have Warren Reinch.
Hi.
We are just finishing our February 2020 edition of The Trumpet. This is our 30th anniversary edition, and it is a special issue about government. We look at all the protests that are going on throughout the world, and we use this to look at the broader questions of the problems with the governments of this world. These questions and some important answers fill this entire issue. And the first few stories that we're going to cover on today's show speak right to this point, starting in America, which is in the middle of a crisis in government. For the third time in American history, a United States president has been impeached. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, after months of arguing and debating over this, the House of Representatives finally had its big impeachment vote this week and voted with a slim majority to impeach President Donald Trump. Vote was definitely right down party lines. There was one independent that voted for both charges of impeachment, and about 229 Democrats voted to impeach Donald Trump for abuse of power. Well, 230, they picked up another one for that vote to charge him with obstruction of Congress. Not a single Republican voted for either measure, which just shows how politically divisive the vote was, and frankly, how political the vote was. The anyone who's been keeping track with the impeachment hearings found that the Democrats testifying against it even admitted that this was their charges of abuse of power were largely based on hearsay. The charges being that he tried to pressure the president of Ukraine by threatening to withhold aid to him to investigate a political rival. They released the transcripts. None of that was in there, and decided to hold a vote anyway, and had about 229 Democrats and one independent decide that they just don't like President Trump. We're going to vote for that charge of abuse of power. They picked up one more vote, 230 plus the independent, for obstruction of Congress, which is a weird term. That's kind of how the checks and balances work. You'd think that the president's job is kind of to obstruct Congress. But actually, I think one of the best analyses of why that claim was bogus comes from actually, surprisingly, a Hillary Clinton supporter and constitutional law expert, Jonathan Turley. He got on CBS this morning and gave an interview talking about, well, this is just what he said. He said, "The most troubling for me is the obstruction of Congress charge. They set an abbreviated period for the investigation, arguably the shortest investigation of any presidential impeachment, depending on how you count the Johnson impeachment days. And then they say if you don't turn over the evidence during that period, you're obstructing Congress. Well, President Trump went to court and challenged the necessity of handing over that material. Both Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon were allowed to go all the way to the Supreme Court. They ultimately lost, and Nixon resigned soon after. My concern is this really does seem like you are making an appeal to the court into a higher crime or misdemeanor." So it's basically saying even taking your case to a court, they've turned into an impeachable offense.
Watching all of this unfold in light of what we've talked about a lot at The Trumpet, what Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has said about the role that Donald Trump is playing, prophetically speaking, within the government. The last article, that major article that he wrote, where he talked about Donald Trump gaining control of his own divided government. The government is more divided than ever, but the indication in prophecy is that he will actually be able to corral some of these rogue elements And you look at the way that this is unfolding, clearly the Democrats do not have a path to being able to remove him from office. I think they're basically just trying to put a black mark on his name. And in some ways, they're kind of boxing themselves in here. His poll numbers have actually gone up over the course of the impeachment. The public doesn't seem to be behind this effort by the Democrats. How are you viewing this in light of what Gerald Fleury has talked about in terms of Trump actually being able to grow in his power and to eliminate some of these kind of deep state anti-Trump elements within the government?
Right. Well, the backlash angle is definitely really significant, and even some liberal sources are realizing that. I had a CNN article about as liberal as you get, entitled "Warning Lights Are Flashing from Democrats as They Impeach Trump," and they bring me that same point you just made about Gallup polls show that since Nancy Pelosi announced this impeachment inquiry back in late September, President Trump's approval ratings have actually gone from 39% to 45%, according to that poll. So he's actually got about a 6% hike in his approval ratings. And so it's definitely conceivable that he may do even better in the next election as Americans get fed up with this political gamesmanship. And that's not even looking at, we're still looking at a trial in the Senate that's been delayed. The House hasn't voted for managers yet, so we'll see how that plays out. But that could, if this goes to trial in the Senate, that could even get even more exposure of the political corruption that could bolster his results in the next election. Where if that happened, it would definitely go a long way to like what Mr. Fleury's talking about getting control of your divided government, is if you can regain control of the House of Representatives, keep control of the Senate. President Trump keeps appointing more and more conservative judges as time goes on. If he goes into a second term, he'll even appoint even more conservative judges, and then you can get to a standpoint where if you've got a big block of conservative judges and you're also appointing more and more bureaucrats, conservative bureaucrat sounds like an oxymoronic term to me, but Trump supporting bureaucrats, that you get there, that over time, I mean, he's made tremendous progress over his first term, getting more and more pro-Trump judges, pro-Trump deep state officials. And if he can do well in the next election, or even better in the next election, because of people getting fed up with this, all the corruption that's being exposed, he'll get even more control of that divided government. I guess we'll just have to wait and see how much control he gets over that divided government. But he's already underway for that prophecy that Mr. Fleury highlights so much in that article. Can President Trump get control of his divided government? Talking about Amos 7 mostly, and this prophecy about an end time Jeroboam, King Jeroboam figure who has control of both a chapel and a court. Yep. That chapel being more like a religious movement that supports the president, but then the court being these government agencies that he keeps making slow but steady progress towards winning back from the radical left.
Yeah, it'll be interesting in the next election to see how much all of this affects the outcome. Whether this actually flips the House of Representatives, that would be quite extraordinary. But the other aspect, I guess, that remains to be seen is just how violently opposed to the president the left gets if they are blocked. If after all of these efforts, he does have a second term in office, you could imagine them becoming even even more unhinged than they are already.
Right, because, well, even the 2016 election, he had control of the House for his first 2 years in office, or the Republicans had control of the House. And there were even some pretty high-ranking officials in the Democratic Party. He's not co-chairman anymore, but Keith Ellison was co-chair at the time, comes to mind, saying that, like, well, we've lost the presidency, we've lost the Senate, we've lost the House, we've lost the Supreme Court, we've lost most of the governorships. They said our only tool left in our toolbox is protest and demonstration.
Yeah.
And you saw, oh, it seems like we even saw maybe even more protest during those first 2 years when the president had control of the Congress than they've had since the Democratic control of the House. It seems to be a little bit of a steam let off valve for them, but as they lose that, I mean, it could be more, it's like, well, if you can't vote this down, we just have to take this to the streets and decide it there.
Well, it's going to be an explosive year, whatever happens after the gambit that the Democrats played here. When it fizzles out, which it will in some at some point or other, the way that they respond to that will be interesting to watch. We'll put links to Andrew's article. He wrote one this week called "What Does President Trump's Impeachment Mean for America?" in the show notes for the program, and also Gerald Fleury's article, "Can President Trump Get Control of His Own Divided Government?" A very important article to take a look at if you haven't read it, or go back and reread it. Continuing with the government theme, we're going to talk now about protests taking place in France, showing the discontent over government in that country. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, we're on day 16 of some pretty massive protests that have been sweeping across a whole range of different sectors in France. You've had about 90% at one point of train drivers have been on strike, shutting down the transport system, causing massive transport problems. You've got teachers on strike. You've got major exams being cancelled because they're joining in. 20% of flights in Paris Airport are cancelled. The Eiffel Tower was closed this week because the Eiffel Tower workers were on strike. Even the Paris Opera, which must make this one of the most musical protest movements outside of Les Miserables, as the opera staff joined in the revolt there. The Associated Press wrote, "Lighting red flares and marching beneath a blanket of multicolored flags, thousands of workers snaked through French cities from Brittany on the Atlantic to the Pyrenees in the south. Hospital workers in scrubs, Air France staff in uniforms, lawyers wearing long black robes, people from across the French workforce joined in the strikes and protests in higher numbers," they're writing about this week, "than the last cross-sector walkout last week." Now, the trigger for these massive strikes has been France's pension schemes. You know, France, as just about all the media will admit, has got one of the most generous pension schemes in the world. For some sectors, you can retire at 55 on a pension that is only just short of somewhere around 80-90% of your final salary. So incredibly generous, unheard of in most of the rest of the developed world. And this job in particular, one of the jobs that you can retire at 55 is the tremendously strenuous job of train driver. So, you know, it's not early retirement for people that are working as firefighters or down mines or that kind of thing. They've got this pension system. They're trying to reform it. They're trying to have a more unified system where the standard age of retirement is 64, still substantially lower than it is in a lot of other developed countries. And you've got all of these strikes. And basically, France has been here before. They tried the same thing in the 1990s. They've got this unaffordable pension scheme. I mean, everywhere in the Western world has an unaffordable pension scheme. I think, you know, if you're in your 20s, your 30s, probably even your 40s, you are not going to receive the pension that the government currently gives out to people that are retiring because the money's just not there. The math doesn't add up. In France, that's especially so. But every time they try and fix the problem, the entire nation has a temper tantrum. And that's pretty much what they've been doing for the past couple of weeks.
There are a lot of protests happening in a lot of countries for a lot of different reasons. This is probably one of the less noble of the reasons that these protests are taking place. But this isn't the only the only reason that people in France are protesting. There have been other protests that have been going on for quite some time. This is really kind of just adding to the instability that we've seen in that country for some time.
Right. And often by itself, if this were the only kind of protest movement going on right now in France or Europe, it wouldn't be that significant. I mean, still, it's majorly disruptive. But protesting is kind of France's national hobby, their national sport. They've gotten through four different republics. They're onto their fifth already. They like to get out and cause trouble. But then you look at everything else that has been happening in that nation and all across Europe, and you get a more complete picture and a picture of an entire continent where there's growing dissatisfaction beyond the normal French propensity to go out and smash stuff. So you look at in France, just in the politics, where the kind of extremist National Rally Party has become one of the country's most popular parties in the European elections. They came in first place. This is the party that used to be called the National Front. They changed the name because of the National Front's association with anti-Semitism, with the far right and kind of far left and extremist ideas. They've tried to make that more palatable with this name change. But their last nationwide election, number one party. Last presidential election, the National Rally leader, Marine Le Pen, came in second place, went into a runoff election, and won 33% of the vote, which was way more than last time they kind of came in second place quite a few years ago. So you've got growing popularity for this party that was once beyond the pale, that only you had to be pretty extreme to support. And then you've got, like you mentioned, these other protest movements. You've got the Yellow Vest movement that has been going on since November last year. That across the country, I think you probably had millions come out at one point or another in support of that protest. And that's more of a, these current protests are very specific. The Yellow Vest protests are more of a general anger against what the government is doing and anger against this mainstream leftist consensus about we need more regulation, need to do more to confront global warming, this kind of a feeling. So you've got a lot of dissatisfaction there. And then you just look all across Europe and you see similar problems. And again, they're not France. They don't necessarily express it in the same big protest movements, but you have the rise of all these fringe parties. You have Spain still this week struggling with making different headlines as one party after another gives up on trying to hold an election. You've got Germany where there's all the speculation. Well, is the government going to fall now? Is it, how long can it even last? Belgium, where they still don't have a government. Italy, where you had just this massive rise in two parties that basically came from nowhere that have completely upended the political system. And you can just go on and on and on. So when you put this in context of everything going on across all of Europe, you see a really deep-seated dissatisfaction with mainstream leaders, mainstream politics, mainstream ways of doing business that goes much further than just being unhappy because of pension reform.
You just did a fantastic job of summarizing a lot of the content of the article that you've just written for this new print edition that we were talking about. And the title of the article is Ripe for the Rise of Demagogues. This kind of discontent that we're seeing in so many of these countries, the way that you look at it in the context of Bible prophecy, this is exactly the kinds of circumstances that would lead to what we see prophetically for Europe. Maybe you could just summarize that aspect of it.
Sure. I mean, one of the big prophecies that we come back to again and again on this show is this longstanding forecast that we've had that there would be a strong leader rising in Germany. And we base that on specific Bible prophecies, and you look at those prophecies and it's a whole climate of authoritarianism in Europe that it talks about. The focus is absolutely on Germany and it being a German strong leader. Passages like Isaiah chapter 10, for example, talk about Assyria being this nation that God uses to correct other powers, and Assyria in Bible prophecy refers to Germany. But you can look at other passages like Revelation chapter 17 that talk about 10 kings. So there are other authoritarian leaders under this strongman. So there's a big political change coming to Europe, according to Bible prophecy. This nation or this continent of democracies becomes a continent of autocracy. at least in terms of 10 of the biggest, most powerful nations there. And that's a trend that France is included in and a whole load of these other countries. And so we're watching for this to happen. We're watching for this political change. And you see this dissatisfaction all across Europe. And it's really paving the way for those prophecies to be fulfilled. And you mentioned that Trumpet Print article. Another place, if you can't wait to learn more about this subject, for those Trumpet Print articles to go up online this week. If you look at today's Key of David program from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, he's not talking about the protest in France. He's looking at this divide and this the way that Emmanuel Macron is criticizing America and this really hatred for America that's emerging in Europe that's called France's Fulfilling Bible Prophecy. But that program as well just gives you a great prophetic overview of what the Bible says about France, what the Bible says is coming to Europe, the role that France is going to play in this European power. I mean, even he goes through some of the prophecies that talk about France being unstable as water, and you see that in their propensity to protest against their governments. So that's also a great place to go to get an overview of what to expect for all of France and Europe as these protest movements progress.
Excellent. Watch the Key of David program this weekend. We'll also put a link to a couple of our trend articles in the show notes for today's program. We have one on there that explains the prophecy about Europe becoming a 10-nation superpower, and also another about a strong man of Germany to lead Europe. And as we said, keep your eyes out for that Trumpet article, which will appear on the website next week when the February 2020 edition of The Trumpet goes online. Thank you for that, Richard. Now over to Algeria, where protests have been unfolding since February of this year. The people just voted in a new president. For this story, we'll turn to Warren Reinsch.
Algeria has finally elected its new president. And this is a trend that goes back. It's had no government for the last 8 months. Way back in April of this year, The president stepped down after large protests. The largest protests since the 2011 Arab Spring occurred in Algeria. So this trend is going on all around the world, and you can see it here in Algeria. This new president he was elected with a 58% majority. It is a large majority there. He was running up against five other candidates, and these candidates were members of the former regime of Bouteflika, and he was the former president. So the people are really frustrated at the government. They are in very poor economic conditions. They're very young. Algeria is a very young nation. About 70% of Algeria is under the age of 30. And these people are they're without jobs. About 25% of them are without jobs. So they're in a very bad economic condition, and they blame that on the government. So they've been protesting, and this new candidate was elected. But they're not accepting him. They have come out in protest, and they said that they don't accept him. The people didn't even go to the elections in many cases. There was about 40% election turnout rate, which is, I believe that was 12% lower than the election in 2014. So people, they don't like the government. They don't want to show up for the election. And they're trying to get this old ruling regime, as they call them, out of the government so that they can replace it with new, younger people. The head of Algeria's election authority said this. They said that this begins a new era and a promising stage of implementation of democracy. But then they said that the electoral process has lived up to the people's expectations and hopes. So this is they're really not seeing that the people don't want this government. They're not really seeing that that the people are going to keep protesting. Since Bouteflika stepped down, these demonstrations have continued to go on. They haven't stopped. They haven't quelled. And the people are calling for this gang, as they call the ruling regime, to be kicked out of office. This is what the NPR writes. They said that the demonstrations see this election stacked with candidates from the old guard as an attempt to push back their movement and to turn back the clock. So they see that the ruling regime is trying to get back in power. After Bouteflika resigned, the ruling regime was pretty weak. They knew that they wouldn't be able to get back into politics very easy. So the people are seeing this as just another attempt to get back into power. But the problem is that isn't going to work. The people aren't going to accept it. They haven't accepted it. They've came out and said that they're not going to accept the government, and they're just going to continue to protest, and you're going to continue to have a bad economic situation here in Algeria.
What are the wider ramifications of this kind of unrest taking place in Algeria? Why would this be of concern geopolitically or prophetically?
Well, Algeria's economy is very reliant on oil. It's one of its largest exports. 95% of its revenue comes from oil. And the important part of that is most of that goes to Europe. Europe really relies on the oil that comes from Algeria. But the problem is this year alone, because of these protests that have been occurring, that revenue from oil dropped 12.5%. So it's having an impact on the economy. And Europe doesn't feel safe with what's going on in Algeria. Mr. Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has an article that he wrote in 2013 entitled Watch Algeria. And he wrote this, quote, "Germany has great power in Africa, even military power, that few people are paying attention to. Germany is not about to give up that power, certainly not without a fight." So they need this oil. They need to have control of Algeria because it is so close to Europe. It's right on the soft underbelly of Europe. They need control of it. And in this situation, this turmoil is creating a situation where there's a lot of radicals that are going through, and it's been an opportunity for radical Islam. There's been a lot of terrorist attacks going on in the region, and radical Islam is trying to take advantage of the situation. But Germany doesn't want that to happen. It needs a stable Algeria. It needs a stable economy so it can get the oil. So it is not going to give up without a fight, as Mr. Fleury said. And that goes right along with prophecy. Daniel 11:40 says that there's going to be a clash between the king of the north and the king of the south, which is radical Islam and Europe, a European power led by Germany. So we can see that is already beginning to happen here in Algeria.
So essentially the unrest that's taking place here, the instability and the public discontent, this opens the door for these radical elements within Algeria to create problems that Europe would be very concerned about. And obviously, if there's a depression or a dip in oil production and oil exports to Europe, this would also be of grave concern. So maybe you could just elaborate a little bit more on Europe's interest in intervening to ensure that it protects its own interests there.
Yeah, well, Germany exports a lot of weapons and armaments to Algeria. Algeria is one of the top five locations of those exports. So it has a lot of military equipment in the region, first of all, but it's also very concerned about terrorism spilling over into Europe. This has happened once before back in the 90s. It's called the Black Decade in Algeria. And that's when there was a very similar situation, poor economic conditions, civil unrest. And then the Islamists took control of it. They gained control of part of the government. And these terrorists were spilling over into France. They conducted a couple terrorist attacks, some of which were very drastic attacks, or very large attacks on the world scene. So we can see that Europe doesn't want that to happen again. They're going to do whatever they can to confront radical Islam, to confront Iran, if they're trying to work in Algeria, and they're going to do what they can to protect those interests in Algeria.
Well, we will put a link to Gerald Fleury's article, Watch Algeria, in the show notes and keep our eyes on what's happening there. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Warren. Amid rising instability, such as what we were just talking about, many nations are ramping up their defenses. One of these is China. Reports are that they are actually building an alarming number of warships. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Chinese Navy is building a really eye-popping number of warships as the country pushes toward modernizing its military. And this week, there was a pretty kind of a rare photo published on a military analysis blog. This photo was snapped through an airplane window, and it captures an unusual level of detail of the Xiangnan shipyard near Shanghai. Military experts have been studying this photo and just you know, analyzing what exactly is captured here, and it shows five of China's type 052D air defense destroyers. Those displace 7,500 tons. They can carry 64 large missiles each, including surface-to-air missiles and cruise missiles. And then the type 052, this one's basically considered to be an equivalent to the U.S. Navy's Arleigh Burke-class Aegis destroyers. So it's a very advanced warship. And five of those are clearly visible in this photo at various stages of completion. And then the picture also shows four of China's Type 055 class destroyers. We've talked about those quite a lot on previous episodes of Trumpet Hour because it's an incredibly sophisticated destroyer. It's so large that it's sometimes actually categorized as a cruiser. But in either case, they can carry over 100 large missiles each. So even if you're only counting destroyers and only counting this one shipyard, that's nine destroyers that are visible here. And to put that into context, the British Royal Navy has a total of six destroyers. So it's quite a number of advanced destroyers that China's bringing online here at the Jiangnan shipyard. And the picture also shows hovercraft being developed there, a massive Yuan Wang-class tracking ship. And the crown jewel of this shipyard is a Type 003 catapult-equipped aircraft carrier. So this photo gives us just what I think is a very interesting and a somewhat rare glimpse into the modernization efforts of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army Navy. And Jiangnan is just one of six massive naval shipyards along the coast of China there, where warships are being built and launched with urgency that is unprecedented.
Just so I understand this picture, was this something that China wanted to publicize, or was this... the information that's coming out about this is this is just intelligence agents that are figuring this out. This information slipped out.
Right, it's the latter. It is a Chinese military blog that published this photo. A Beijing-based analyst who snapped it. But it's the type of thing that China probably likes to have leaked. They like the world to see and tremble at what they're developing, but they generally are not very transparent themselves about these kinds of developments. So this was very much a private operation that this photo emerged, but it's still the sort of thing that the government is probably not too sad about.
But this wasn't the only news along this front. That there was something more official that the president announced this week.
Yes, actually, Chinese President Xi Jinping this week, it was on Tuesday, he officially commissioned the Shandong aircraft carrier into service. So this is China's first homegrown aircraft carrier, the first one that they've domestically built. This was built in a different shipyard, the Dalian shipyard, and it's China's second aircraft carrier in total, with the first one being the Soviet-made carrier that was launched by the PLA Navy about 8 years ago or so. And this homegrown one, the Shandong, is based mainly on that Soviet design. But there are some improvements and some expansions and other modifications. This one can actually carry 36 warplanes, which is a dozen more than the first carrier. And the fact that it was built indigenously is really being seen as a major advance for China's military machine. And when you add it all up, as of Tuesday, the Chinese Navy now has two active aircraft carriers, 23 long-range air defense destroyers, 30 ocean-going frigates, and then dozens of corvettes, dozens of missile boats, dozens of submarines, and all kinds of other vessels. So it's all really expanding China's reach and just significantly boosting China's ability to enforce its claims over the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and other parts of its periphery. And as this development continues, this will also boost China's ability to secure its overseas holdings in far-flung locations all over the world.
Our editor-in-chief has talked about why this is so important prophetically. These kinds of provocations are really exactly what we would expect based on the Bible's prophecies.
That's exactly right. Trumpet editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has really called quite a lot of specific attention to China's naval buildup and the way it's enabling China to enforce its claims. He's especially focused on the South China Sea. And he said that this trend is vital to watch because it's steering the world toward war. That was the title of his July 2016 article on this topic. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. And he explains in that piece that China's naval power is enabling it to claim more and more Asian maritime areas that, according to international law, belong to Brunei, the Philippines, Malaysia, Taiwan, Vietnam, countries like that. And he writes, quote, China is ignoring these nations' territorial claims and is being aggressive and provocative and thereby challenging 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. This aggressive behavior should alarm the world.
Yeah. We will put a link to that article, China is Steering the World Toward War, in the show notes, as well as this article that Jeremiah has written, China is Building an Alarming Number of Warships. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. Before we take a quick break, I want to quickly look at similarly troubling news coming out of Germany, whose submarine fleet is getting some upgrades. For this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, so back in October, Germany announced that it was producing 6 more Type 212 diesel-electric attack submarines, and this basically caused the national interest to write a really good article just focusing on Germany's submarine fleet. Germany's become one of the world leaders, along with Sweden, in diesel attack submarines. And these submarines are incredibly stealthy. There was kind of a big event a few years ago where one of Sweden's submarines, their Gotland-class submarine, just kind of ran rings around the U.S. Navy in war games. They just couldn't detect these Swedish submarines. And so Germany's building a lot of these, and they're dramatically cheaper to build than the massive kind of nuclear submarines that America builds. And this article just draws attention to Germany becoming a world leader and making their own and exporting them around the world. And this caught our eye because this is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury drew attention to in his January 2020 Trumpet magazine. And he just pointed out about how Germany is a major submarine manufacturer. It makes submarines even for Israel that can carry nuclear warheads. And he talked about just, you know, Germany's history in submarine warfare, in surprise warfare, and just said, well, you know, look, they're becoming such a world leader in this one area. Isn't that something that we should all be concerned about?
Well, we'll link to that article. Is KT Zu Gutenberg about to come to power? In the show notes. And we have an article by Daniel DeSanto up on the website right now, Germany's Silent Weapon, with more information about this submarine program. Thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, massive spending in the plans for the United States and Britain, and a warning that World War III is coming soon. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The news out of the U.S. and Britain has been overwhelmed by impeachment in the U.S. and Boris Johnson's victory in the U.K., so much so that another big story in both countries was overlooked. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, in both countries, we're seeing a massive increase in spending. This week, the Senate approved a $1.4 trillion spending package, and that was passed on to Mr. Trump. This was something, you know, you see all the, we talked about all the division, the disagreement in the first half, talking about the impeachment scandal. But when it comes to borrowing tons of money and spending tons of money, that's something that you can get bipartisan consensus on. It passed through the House and the Senate. The bill was split into two chunks. One chunk even passed through 81 votes to 11, not many people opposing it. Now, the reason why they split this package into two chunks is that Mr. Trump said, well, I'm not going to pass another omnibus spending bill. You know, these things, they're massive. They increase the debt. There's so many things in there. You know, you can't say, well, I don't like this and I don't like that. You've kind of got to take it as one package. I am not going to approve any more omnibus spending bills. So instead, what they did was pass two bills which they then, within minutes of each other, they basically just chopped it in half, and it's still an omnibus spending bill, just not very thinly disguised. So massive spending in the UK, in the US. And then meanwhile, in the UK, also yesterday, we had the government set out their priorities for the next 5 years or so in the state opening of Parliament. And Boris Johnson had a really positive speech, and he talked about bringing a new golden age to Britain, and obviously about getting Brexit done. But apart from that, the big, big standout was massive spending projects. He talked about how it was the most radical Queen speech in a generation, but he just, was talking about spending anything, things on anything and everything. Fraser Nelson in The Telegraph this morning wrote, "The Queen's speech offered a bulging Santa sack of goodies more generous than any offered by any previous Tory or Conservative prime minister." So massive NHS spending, raising the minimum wage so that one in six will be working in Britain will be on that minimum wage, spending on schools, spending on faster broadband, spending on infrastructure. He's even talking about potentially building a bridge to Ireland. So some big, impressive projects, but all funded on massive borrowing. Fraser Nelson wrote, "We can forget about the old-fashioned Tory ambition to balance the books. National debt is set to go on rising for the foreseeable future." And that's the case in Britain and America. And you can see how this could bring some immediate economic benefits, all of this money surging through the economies. But at the same time, it showed, there's some massive financial problems that just can't keep going this way in the long run.
Well, the dangers of this kind of spending definitely getting overlooked among all these other more eye-popping headlines, but it certainly will have serious long-term consequences. If you wanted to direct people to more information about this and to understand why it's important prophetically, where would you send them, Richard?
I think one good place to go, it's an article called "The King of Debt" that Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry wrote in the April 2018 Trumpet article. That just goes through the massive spending that we saw back then. It's probably some of those numbers are still outdated already, but the analysis is spot on. The historical record, he goes back and quotes George Washington warning about exactly this type kind of problem, talks about the moral implications of a nation that kind of lives for this instant gratification, please the self, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. And then just what the Bible says as well about a nation that does this and behaves this way. So that's "Debt is a Moral Issue," with warnings from history, warnings from the Bible, and pointing to the real solution to this problem as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. We spoke in the first half about protests in France and Algeria. Another place where protests have been very strong is in Lebanon. And that country, too, held an election this week, but the outcome isn't likely to quell the public discontent. For this, we'll go back to Warren Reinsch.
Yeah. On Thursday, this new prime minister in Lebanon was selected. His name is Hassan Diab. He was named by the president, so he has the president's support. He was voted in with a majority in the parliament, so he has the parliament's support. But there's one major problem, and that's he's a Shiite Muslim. The way that the election works in Lebanon is that there's a large split between the Christians, the Shiite Muslims, and the Sunni Muslims. By law, the president is Christian, the speaker of the parliament is a Shiite Muslim. But then the prime minister, by law, is Sunni Muslim. So this candidate is not Sunni. He's a Shiite Muslim. And it really shows that Hezbollah is working to grab more control of the country. There's been large protests that have been going on in Lebanon. And in the midst of that, Hezbollah is working to grab more control. The Associated Press writes this. They said that the president failed to get the support of Lebanon's major Sunni leaders, including the prime minister. And then it says that this is the key, because under the country's sectarian-based system, the premier must be from the Sunni community. So they're working around the law, and they're trying to get more power in the government, to get more power in the country of Lebanon. And there's a large conflict in interest here. The people don't want this specific candidate, yes, but they're a larger degree. They don't want Hezbollah being in control. And there's been a lot of demonstrations about that. And there's been a lot of protests going on as well. The Carnegie Center wrote this. The problem is that he is coming on as a weakened prime minister. They're saying that this candidate is weak. He doesn't have the strength and he's not going to be able to come together in this time of turmoil. He's not going to be able to bring the nation together because he is weak and he doesn't have the people's support.
Well, we've been talking about how these protests in Lebanon really presage a change in leadership in the country and a weakening of Hezbollah's position in that country. Prophecy shows that Hezbollah is going to have its position weakened and eventually broken free of Iran's influence, that it will shift more to a moderate direction and align with Europe. That's what Psalm 83 tells us. So it seems like the way that this is unfolding, it shows Hezbollah is trying to look for a way to hold on to its claim to power in that country, but that it's given the way that people are responding to this isn't going to work.
No, yeah, the people don't want this. They've been protesting this. They say that the this guy is a part of a class class of politicians that they oppose. That was their words. So they're against this politician, and the Hezbollah is really trying to grab control. They already have a large control in the nation. They have one of the largest political parties in the parliament. They have a lot of different ministries, including the health ministry, and this allows them to siphon a lot of money. Iran is in a really bad situation right now, and Hezbollah is feeling the struggle. They're not getting as much funding from Iran, so they're doing what they can to try and stay in control. They don't have that extra funding, so they have to reach out a little bit more. So you can kind of see that is going on. They've been sanctioned a lot by the United States, and that's also hurting their finances. So you can really see them grasping for power in this situation here. And as you mentioned, Psalm 83 mentions that there is going to be a turn in the power where Lebanon right now is in under Hezbollah. It's aligned with Iran, but that's going to change, and they're going to align with Europe.
Thank you for that, Warren. We will put a link to that article by Gerald Fleury on the subject, Why You Need to Watch Lebanon, in the show notes for today's program. And you can look that up for more understanding of the prophetic significance of what's happening here and that prophecy in Psalm 83 that is so critical. Well, Russia's top general issued a chilling warning this week. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia's highest-ranking general, Valery Gerasimov, gave an address on Wednesday, and he said that he believes World War III could be very near. He said that the Western world has given Russia what he calls adversary status, and he talked about NATO's recent calls for faster deployment on Europe's eastern flank, so that's the regions that border Russia. And Gerasimov said he thinks the West may be preparing for what he called large-scale military conflict. And he said, quote, "Work continues on the deployment of U.S. missile defense components in Europe. In the Baltic countries and Poland, the Black and Baltic Seas, military activity is intensifying. The intensity of the bloc's military exercises is rising. Their scenarios point to NATO's targeted preparation for engaging its forces in a large-scale military conflict." So he's implying throughout all this that in response to this Western activity, Russia needs to build up its own firepower more. But the basic gist of his message is just he's pointing to the potential for something big, something large-scale to break out.
It seems like this is kind of the way Russia does business, that they always have an explanation for what they're doing, that every time they're taking territory, they claim that it's in response to provocations from the other side. It seems like in reality, the people of Europe have much more to fear from the aggressiveness of Russia than the other way around.
I think you're right. It is a little bit of a chicken and the egg situation, and neither party here is guiltless. Russia does, anytime someone criticizes what happened in Ukraine in 2014, they say, well, look at what Germany did in the late 90s in the Balkans. Yeah. We were only kind of answering that. But yes, it's typical for Russia to play the victim. We are building up our firepower, but it's only because the Europeans are doing it first. The Americans are antagonizing us, so we have to boost our missile, you know, systems here and there. So it's the kind of rhetoric that we expect from Russia.
But the bottom line is they do, whether it's pretext or not, this is a reason for them to build up their military even more.
It is, for sure. Regardless of who kind of started the military buildup, Russia feels justified, totally justified. And in fact, Gerasimov here is essentially saying that they would be remiss not to build up their forces in response to kind of NATO's intensifying activities there near the frontier. And at one point, he even cautioned against incidents of buzzing of warships and things like that, which have been increasing between NATO and Russia in Eastern Europe. He cautioned against that because he said large-scale war could spiral out of a small conflict of that kind.
Whether what he's saying is true or not in terms of the reasons for Russia's buildup, he is right in that World War III is very soon.
Yes. Yeah, the Bible actually discusses the nuclear age that we are now in. It doesn't use the word nuclear anywhere, of course, but in Matthew 24, 21 through 22, Christ says that just before his return, mankind will be engulfed in a war so violent that if it were not interrupted, it would wipe out mankind. So the technology to do that wasn't really possible before the modern age. But now in a world of thousands of nuclear weapons, you know, warheads in Russia and the U.S., China, India, Pakistan, the U.K., France, Israel, most recently North Korea, now mankind has the tools to accomplish its own extermination. So it really helps us to date the Bible's prophecies about the end time. And it helps us see that we are in that end time now, and that in a general way, Gerasimov is right. World War III is coming soon, and it will be nuclear. But where he's wrong is that the Bible makes clear that World War III won't start with a conflict between Russia and the U.S., or Russia and any Western nation, at least not in the early phases. The scriptures show that it'll actually be sparked by a push from a Middle Eastern power against Europe, which Warren touched on a little bit in the first half.
Yeah. Where would you send people for more information?
Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Darrell Fleury has a booklet called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, and he goes through all of the relevant prophecies. He shows that even though this points to a time of unbelievable chaos, that it's tied to the most hope-filled event in human history. So it's a very powerful booklet.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. One final story here about a new children's book published in Canada. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is quite a shocking story. We've covered on the Trumpet for a number of years the trend of like the rising interest in occult practices in America and other Western nations, especially amongst millennials. But this story is about even attempts to try to even push this this movement on children as young as five, where you've got in Toronto, there's a publisher, Koyoma Press, that just published a book by a cultist titled The Children's Book of Demons. And it's like a coloring book, so it's supposed to be made out in like a fun, quote-unquote fun, interactive way that's saying that like, hey, don't want to take out the trash tonight. Maybe you're swimming in homework. Perhaps a bully is being a real drag. This is from their Amazon.com page. We'll grab colored pencils and draw sigils and dial up some demons. So like the teens, like 5 to 10-year-olds, to like summon demons to help with their problems. And I tried to look for like what the sales number for this book. I didn't find much. I'm hoping that there's not a lot of people buying this sort of thing, but we do have an article that's going to go up on the website by Daniel DeSanto that covers that this Koyoma Press, it's partly funded by the province of Ontario, so it's not like a fringe weird publisher that decided this was a good book to have on their publishing record. It's getting state funds from the Canadian government, and so yeah, kind of a very concerning trend as this these occult practices go to younger and younger ages, but also in
in an ironic way, really throws a spotlight that you don't hear much today about the root cause of lawlessness and rebellion in society. Because, I mean, this book saying, hey, your parents are wanting to make you take out the trash and you don't want to do it, so ask demons for help. I mean, that is Ephesians 2, verse 2 says Satan is the prince of the power of the air that works in the children of disobedience. So, I mean, he is the one that's broadcasting the attitude to get mad at your parents for making you take out the trash. I guess in a weird way, the book actually does put a highlight on the real cause of a lot of these just rebellion and lawlessness in society, but in a twisted way of actually encouraging children to overtly instead of covertly fall under these influences.
We do have an article that will be going up on the website next week by Daniel DeSanto called Children's Book Teaches That Demons Are Fun. And we will put a link to the chapter in Mystery of the Ages by Herbert W. Armstrong, Mystery of Angels and Evil Spirits, in the show notes. This is such an important subject to understand the truth about. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Warren Reinsch, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Victor Hugo. Laughter is the sun that drives winter from the human face. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.